Hello and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Tricarci, and we have an awesome episode for you today. Because after years of a stop and go market that's been held back by what we refer to as compound volatility, we are finally seeing some clear signs of a new wave of M&A activity. Over the last few weeks, we've seen a surge in buy-side demand, and it's about to meet a parking lot full of assets. And this time, it feels like the boom we've been waiting for might actually be here. But doing deals is one thing. Creating value from them, well, that's a whole other story. In fact, our research shows that more than 57% of all acquisitions actually destroy shareholder value. That's crazy. So what separates the winning deal makers from the rest of the pack? Well, that's where my guests come in today, because I have called in our top two deal makers, Dean Bell and Carol Stryker, who lead our M&A practice. They're going to break down the current market signals. What are they hearing? What are they seeing? They're going to help us determine if this new wave is for real. They're going to unpack why so many deals fall short and explore the data-driven strategies of acquirers that consistently outperform. And yes, this conversation will be eligible for a full CPE credit. We're finalizing that version now. So keep an eye on our website at kpmg.com/us/FRV podcast. I'll put a link in the episode description. And in the meantime, here's the conversation with Dean and Carol. Dean Bell, Carol Stryker, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here, Nick.
Yeah, I've really been looking forward to this podcast because this past few years have felt like a constant barrage of uncertainty for deal makers. We've gone from a pandemic to rising interest rates and inflation to tariffs, geopolitical tensions. It's been one thing after the next, but it feels like the M&A market is starting to pick up. But it also feels like we've been here before, which is why I'm really excited to have both of you on the podcast today, because I can't think of two better people to help us make sense of this moment and answer the big question I think that's on everyone's mind, which is this time for real? And Dean, you know, there's the saying that you have to understand the past to know the present. And I want to start there and ask you to share how these past few years have shaped the M&A market and maybe more importantly, the mindset of deal makers.
Yeah, Nick, it's a really important question because I just call it, you know, we call it here compound volatility. It's this overall view of a real stop and go market for the past few years where you've got periods of green shoots and optimism. And then next thing you know, this new variable like Liberation Day that slows things down. But as you said, we're seeing a lot of good activity right now since the summer. And because of that activity, we're feeling pretty good about what's to come. And I can tell you the last few weeks, we've seen some really nice activity as well as further supports that. So the good thing is that with that activity, it's going to mean that deal makers now got to think about how they're going to have the right level of discipline to help them understand what a good deal looks like and move that forward, because now's the time to strike.
Yeah, it's exciting. And, you know, it's fascinating, just the psychology of the deal market. You know, it seems like we're at a major inflection point, which is, you know, shifting from that deal fever of 2021 to, like you said, Dean, a more, you know, maybe measured and strategic mindset that's been born out of this compound volatility, which I love that phrase, by the way. So Dean, are we seeing that translate into the numbers? Like, what's the data telling us about market activity?
Yeah, so our data is about the first three quarters of 2025. And in the US, the overall M&A total was $1.9 trillion. Nick, that's up 27% from last year and double what we saw 2 years ago. And so to be clear, we're still not where we were in the record-breaking frenzy of 2021, but the market is definitely more active. And as a result, it's also rational, but there's a cautious optimism we're focusing on right now too.
Got it. Yeah, those are some good trends, right? And are there certain sectors that you're seeing, Dean, driving up that volume?
I'll say that all sectors, Nick, are really moving things forward. But of course, I've got to call out technology. I mean, they are the powerhouse. You think about the urgent needs right now regarding AI, digital capabilities. No doubt they're doing things in that space by a wide margin. And then beyond that, industrial manufacturing, as companies try to think about acquiring domestic suppliers to help de-risk from the supply chains in terms of the tariff concerns. And then the last two I'd mention will be healthcare and energy. Those have both been really resilient. And we've seen for each of those right now in the past 9 months, over $200 billion in activity this year. So that tells you that innovation is definitely pushing things forward, as well as the view of energy transition.
I mean, it makes sense with all the headlines, AI, tariffs, and the infrastructure that needs to go with the technology. So Carol, let me bring you in here. You know, I know you're deeply ingrained into the private equity space. So is all of this tracking with what you're seeing on that front? You know, are the mindset deal trends similar, or is there a different story unfolding there?
Yeah, it's similar, but there is some differences. So I would say from a sector perspective, a lot of similarity there. But what I would say is that our corporates, we've seen a little bit more of that increase that Dean was talking about playing true in our corporates. And in our private equity sector, it is, you know, slightly down year over year, and, you know, fairly significantly down from the highs that we used to see. What it really is telling us and what we're seeing is sponsors are just being really selective, and there's still a valuation gap. All that being said, what we've started to see just in the last quarter is an increase within private equity. And so I think the momentum over the last few weeks and months has really started to change the trajectory of what we're seeing from a PE perspective. There is what I would say is kind of a parking lot full of assets that are waiting to be sold. We've been helping our clients get assets ready for sale, but they've been holding back to bring those out to sale until they think the market is ripe for that. And so that's kind of where we're at with the private equity. No lack of assets that are ready to sell. It's just that they're not launching their sales processes yet.
I mentioned the word psychology earlier. Like, based on what you're talking about, what's the mood for these private equity firms that have this parking lot of assets? Are they feeling pressure from the limited partners to return capital, or, you know, are they confident they can wait for the market to come to them?
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're feeling that pressure. You know, there's also the trend of them using continuation vehicles to monetize some of the assets. So that's a trend that we've seen increase. But the part of the market within private equity where we're just not seeing as much as those sponsor to sponsor deals. But yes, to your point around the pressure that they're having is definitely there. And if they want to raise more money, if they want to get more money, then they're going to have to be able to return their investment to their partner. So that needs to happen.
So let me just maybe do a mini recap of this picture that I think we've painted so far. You know, Carol, you've talked about how there's sellers that are largely waiting on the sidelines, although we're starting to see some of that change and maybe are anchored to some of those valuations of the past. And then Dean, on the other side, you've talked about how we have this more disciplined group of buyers that are being very strategic about how they spend their capital. So I'm guessing that dynamic has kept a lot of potential deals on ice, but we're starting to see things thaw. And Dean, you mentioned the last couple of weeks. I want to zoom in on that and ask you, what are you seeing right now? Are we seeing signs that this could be the beginning of something much bigger?
Yeah, and as I mentioned, the last 4 to 6 weeks, I wanted to focus on even the last couple of days. The activity is there, but really starting to be buy side now. When I looked at last year, we saw a lot of sell sides, which is, to Carol's point, getting things ready for sale. Now you've got buyers lining up. And so after the really long pause, you've got buyers right now actively ready to transact. And I think the prospects of rate cuts, that's giving people the encouragement to move forward. And I think the other thing is just the logjam is breaking right now. And so when you think about having good assets in the marketplace, it's going to create more competition, drive up the price, and then shift the power dynamic back to the sellers who are trying to maximize their sale price for their assets. So I do believe that buyers being interested in good assets is going to bode well for these seller prices, but it just tells us that the marketplace is starting to heat up again.
All right. I mean, it sounds like the buy side demand is heating up. So Carol, you know, what's it going to take for the sellers to start bringing some of those parking lot assets online?
Yeah, you know, it ultimately comes down to, I think, this wave of waiting to see what happens. Like you said in the kickoff, Nick, we've been here before where we see some momentum. We saw that kind of in the Q1 period, and then it didn't really materialize, and maybe that was having to do with Liberation Day. So I've heard the analogy, and I like it around the Jaws analogy. Right. Everyone's sitting there waiting to see if it's safe to go in. And we're going to see a handful of buyers and sellers try to come together over these next couple months. And how I look at it is everybody else is saying, is it safe to go in the water? right? And if these assets that transact and transact in a positive way, that's what we're going to see, is a lot more people jumping in the water and moving it forward.
I love that analogy, Carol. I think it's great. And it's very timely. You know, this is obviously the 50th year anniversary of Jaws. And it hits home for me personally, because I actually let my two kids watch Jaws this summer. And let's just say it got me into some hot water with my wife, who didn't think it was age appropriate.
Yes. Well, my 17-year-old is still afraid of sharks from watching Jaws. So warning to any other parents out there, maybe you should wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, I think my son's only 8, so I think we may have to be dealing with this for a while. But I love the theme. I want to keep it going. And Dean, let me come back to you. And let's talk about a couple of, you know, these proverbial sharks that have been circling over the last couple of years. You know, I want to start with interest rates. You mentioned this already, but we've kind of been in this high rate environment for a while, although we've seen the Fed cut rates in September and then just again at the end of October. So what are we forecasting there in terms of the outlook? And then what are you hearing from deal makers in terms of how that's going to shape the market going forward?
Yeah, Nick. So our economists are talking about one more rate cut, about 25 bips this year, with more to come in 2026. And you go back to the overall dealmaker sentiment, what they want is certainty. And so having the certainty will be very good. They'll factor that into their considerations when making a deal. What I can tell you, though, is that it is a key component, because there'll be other things you look at. Does that mean that, going back to our overall survey we did in the beginning of the year, it said if rates were to be cut, there'd be more activity in the marketplace. And I do wonder if there's a direct correlation there, where as we see rates get cut, we see more activity. But nonetheless, what I tell you is it does make deals cheaper to finance, but the reality is it's one component of the consideration. But I think the good news for deal makers is that when you talk about this rate cut, they will be very much active, because what they told us back in our survey, this is a key component for them.
And Carol, you know, you mentioned the valuation gap earlier. Is this something you see that can start to shrink that?
Yeah, from a valuation perspective, absolutely. I think that there's the 10-year rate that they're already pricing in the rate cuts. So I think that the point that Dean made that's really important is that they just want certainty. And what we've experienced over the last several quarters and, you know, arguably years, is a very increasing interest rate, and it was not very certain.
Certainty is the key word. I think we've been dealing with a lot of uncertainty, as we talked about, and no bigger contributor of that probably than the regulatory environment and tariffs in particular. You know, as you guys know, we just did the US CEO outlook, and it showed that regulatory pressure is a top five concern of CEOs this year. And I think tariffs are a big part of that. So Carol, I want to ask specifically about tariffs. How is that situation impacting the deal market? Maybe how it's been over the last couple of months, and then now what we're seeing with some of the newer developments. Is that expected to change things?
We're really looking at things from a tariff-adjusted EBITDA, right? What are we seeing from a diligence standpoint? How are we thinking about the different scenarios around tariffs? We have a tariff modeler that we use to help drive that for our clients, because it is very volatile right now.
Yeah, I've seen that modeler in action. We did a tariff podcast a few months ago. It's really slick. And I mean, I got to imagine it's a huge asset in diligence, as you can quickly model all these different scenarios. And this term tariff adjusted EBITDA, I haven't heard that, honestly, Carol. I'm just curious how that's being used. Like, is this sellers trying to add back tariff costs, or is this buyers running those models and scenarios and trying to price in the risk of tariffs?
Great question, Nick. It's more the latter. So when buyers are doing the diligence, they're looking at the asset and saying, okay, you know, these are the different scenarios. And so how do I think about those potential impacts to EBITDA?
And so are you seeing this start to like elongate the diligence timeline? It feels like there's a lot more work that's being done by buyers when you factor in all the, you know, uncertainty they're trying to model for, and the fact that they have this more strategic mindset. Are we seeing that impact the diligence timeline?
Yeah, Nick, it's a really interesting question, because we have definitely seen over the last year, year and a half, an elongated sale process. But I think there's a lot of different dynamics at play there, meaning that there was a lot of unknown. And so a lot of things, like you said, that you need to do more diligence, understand more of the complexities, do different scenarios. But it also wasn't a seller's market per se. And so the buyers were able to take that extra time that they felt like they might need and do more diligence and really get conviction around the deal. What I think is an interesting part of this question is that pendulum shifting right now. And I don't have an answer. It'll be interesting to revisit that in three months from now. But what I would say is that there's a decent chance of that pendulum shifting, because what we're seeing is, again, a lot more sellers bringing their assets to market. There is a little bit more of an uptick in the deal market within private equity, especially right now. And so if there is more buyers coming after an asset, the sellers are going to be able to hold a little bit of a tighter timeline that we used to see, gosh, in 21, where we'd see things go preemptive or, you know, 2 or 3 week strict timeline, get as much done in as short a period of a time as possible. So we'll see how the next few months go if there's a shift.
And Carol, that point on the pendulum, you think about just what that means. If the time horizon is shortened and you've got all these new risks you're thinking about, you got to do a lot more in that diligence window. And it's going to mean really leaning into where the risks are to allow us to feel good as those providing diligence for our clients to make sure they got what they need in that time window.
And Dean, just picking up on that, you know, if you got to do more diligence in less time and we're dealing with these new risks, it seems like a big asset today that we maybe didn't have in 2021 is AI to help, you know, get through all that. So how are you seeing AI being used right now as a strategic tool to manage all of this uncertainty in the diligence process?
I think many companies are leaning into AI. I know that we are in particular. It's involved in all that we're doing. When I think about contract intelligence and trying to analyze thousands of agreements to understand the risks around that, like, you know, unfavorable change of control terms, that's important. Thinking about some of our tech diligence and cybersecurity, not just doing a passive policy review, but really using AI to go through and really probe a target's network for there could be some concerns, and want to make sure we're thinking about that. And finally, I think the biggest use is just how you analyze unstructured operational data, like production logs, and trying to understand where there could be bottlenecks. But I'd say to you that the critical part is to be able to have this information to give the buyer the ability to really have a value creation plan from day one that can apply. And so I'd say to you again, Nick, that we're using it to help enhance our processes, and I think many companies are as well.
Yeah, there's some awesome use cases. And it makes a lot of sense when you're trying to sift through all that data in the data room. And I think that cyber example you gave is interesting. Dean, like the question that comes to my mind is, let's say you find a vulnerability, like, is that a deal killer, or is that just go into the negotiation of, you know, something you price in, or maybe you ask for an indemnity on?
If they can't remedy it, at least make a situation the seller can go deal with, that could be a walkaway situation. But if the asset is good enough, and the buyer's got a remediation plan to make that go away, they can consider that as well.
So while we're on the topic of AI, I want to zoom out a little bit, maybe from the diligence to what I think is the bigger elephant in the room, which is the urgent need to invest in AI. And Dean, you mentioned this earlier, that it's been a major deal driver. And our CEO survey I mentioned definitely echoes that, because there was 84% of leaders said that they believe an AI native company could disrupt their industry just within 3 years. And, you know, we just spent a lot of time talking about how companies are being more prudent than ever. So Carol, I want to ask you, like, when you only have so much capital to go around, how are you advising CEOs on that critical decision of whether they should try to build AI capabilities internally or buy them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, there's a couple different things I would say. First of all, is that when we're looking at companies, far too many are putting that AI label, slapping that label on to say it sounds like an AI company. When you peel back the onion, maybe it's not. And so I think that there's, you know, a little bit of that in the diligence phase, right? To make sure you really are getting something that is helping solve your business problem. You know, what is it that you're trying to solve? What is it that you need to do with AI? And make sure it's real. But then let's talk about your point around, I think, build versus buy. And, you know, it's a lot around that is speed. How quickly can you build versus going out to market? And in this world, speed is, I would argue, really hard to build internally, the things that you need. Now, if you can, great. But I would say what we're seeing is a lot more of our clients partnering with and acquiring the AI that they feel like they need in their business to fast forward what's happening to disrupt their business.
Yeah, it makes sense. AI is just changing so quickly that it feels like, to your point, speed is the premium here. You know, if you're really trying to create value through an acquisition. And that is what I'm going to use as the segue to the next part of this conversation. I want to really focus on, I think, just the fundamental question at the heart of every deal, AI or not, and that's value creation. It's probably the most overused term in deal making, as I'm starting to learn through this process. But I want to ask you, what does it actually mean, Carol? Like, when you strip away the jargon, what is value creation?
Yeah, so it's our way of helping our clients really create value through the deal. And in the simplest way, it's, you know, 1 + 1 needs to be worth more than 2. It is really thinking about synergies of doing a deal. You can have cost synergies. You can have revenue synergies. It can be around really strategic repositioning, you know, like entering into a new market for our clients. Or really, the last piece is just improving their standalone performance by putting more operational discipline into their processes. So those are the different ways how we help our clients create value through the deal.
Makes sense, but you're blowing my mind with that math right there. 1 + 1 being more than 2, but you know, it sounds great. It sounds great. My question is, how do you actually measure it? Because I don't know, it's got to be hard to isolate the impact of the deal itself from just the general macro conditions that might be impacting a company's valuation or stock price. How do we do that?
You know, there's a few ways, but we measure it by analyzing the TSR, the total shareholder return, relative to a relevant index. You know, it's a market adjusted metric that isolates the deal's performance. You know, in our most recent M&A dance study, we examined kind of this value creation. And what it revealed is that the market gives acquirers the benefit of doubt with a stock price bump. But the research found that over 57% of the deals, that those gains evaporate within 2 years. And then the deal ends up destroying value, which I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast does not want to have, is that destroying of value.
So first, I just got to say that M&A dance study was fantastic. I mean, I think my listeners will attest that I don't just say this about everything we do at KPMG, but that was really insightful and just the amount of data that was in it. I really enjoyed reading it. And that statistic that you just mentioned blew my mind. You know, it's basically suggesting that the odds of a deal actually creating value are worse than a coin flip, which is just crazy to me. So Dean, like, why is that hit rate so low?
We got to keep it real here, Nick. I mean, the reasons why these deals fail so often is because of two things. One, acquirers often overestimate the benefits and overpay. Or two, they often fail to operationalize the gains because integration complexities are really underestimated. And that's the situation. I think going into a deal, you know what you want to do. It's just sometimes harder to execute.
I guess, Dean, on that overpayment point that you're making, are you suggesting that deals with a lower purchase price premium create more value or not necessarily?
Yeah, you'd think that way. But you know, going back to our M&A dance study you talked about, it was a more nuanced relationship. So you think about this, a higher proportion of deals with larger premiums generated positive value. And our thought is that aligns with the principle of prioritizing a wonderful company at a fair price over a fair company at a wonderful price.
I mean, it's almost counterintuitive. You know, you would think if you pay a lower price, it's going to create more value, but it sounds like value creation is less about the price and more about the deal thesis, which means I'm guessing that thesis needs to be crystal clear. Am I right?
Absolutely. Got to be data driven. You got to focus on how the company will be better post a transaction. Otherwise, as Carol said, these deals will fail.
Yeah. And Carol, I guess we're saying you have to have this clear data-driven deal thesis, and you have to have strong conviction in the asset that you're buying. But then you're doing this diligence, which is designed to uncover new information. So it's an interesting dynamic. Like, how do you advise a client on knowing when it's time to walk away from that thesis and the deal if the data you're getting from diligence maybe isn't supporting that initial conviction?
Yeah, it's a great question. And Nick, it's not always easy, right? People get really excited. You can see people get married to the deals. And start to, you know, make it work on paper. We see that far too often. So you've got to have the courage to walk away from deals when it doesn't make sense. We also advise our clients that you've got to have good cop, bad cop. You've got to have somebody who is not married to the deal that's also involved in the process to make sure that we're appropriately pressure testing what we're finding and making sure it's making its way into the model and the overall investment thesis appropriately. I would also say that, you know, we have to differentiate between a flawed asset and a flawed thesis. And really understanding when you're finding this information during diligence, what is the ability to fix that issue? Is it a non-fixable issue and you should just have that courage to walk away? Or is it something that even though you thought coming into the deal thesis, it was one thing, you learned something else, but if you make some changes and work to solve that issue, if there's operational challenges, for example, that you can do post-close and you still think it would make sense to do the deal, then it comes really down to, is that a different cost basis for you? Can you renegotiate the price, making sure you still have that sufficient return? And so those are the nuances as we think about helping our clients think through it. You know, what are the ones that you just need to walk away from versus renegotiate and or change your deal thesis based on the information that you found.
Let's pivot now to the other major reason that Dean mentioned as to why, you know, more than half of all the deals fail to create value. And that was the complexity in capturing synergies through integration. Carol, what's that relationship between synergies and integration?
The way we describe it is that synergies are the what. They're the value that you hope to capture. And then integration is the how. You cannot have one without the other. The integration efforts must be centered on the deal's value drivers, really from day one, and focused on how you're going to go after and get those value drivers.
Yeah, so it goes back to having that clear deal thesis that everything has to be anchored to. And Dean, you know, you mentioned synergies earlier, and I think everybody thinks of cost synergies, right? Which obviously are a huge piece of value creation, but there's also revenue synergies too, right? Can you just talk about what those are and how you go about capturing them?
Yeah, this is a really important one because revenue synergies can come from, you know, better cross-selling across, let's say, a geographic region or expansion. That definitely is probably one of the most exciting ones that we see. But the one thing I'll tell you about the revenue synergies is that this is one that's so challenging to assess pre-deal. And so you have what Carol mentioned, a lot of thoughts and ideas on paper, but what you're trying to do, I think, in the diligence process is conducting detailed account level assessments to allow yourself to feel you have those synergies in place and make just the broad assumptions around them.
And I imagine, again, that's another area where AI can help get into that detailed data to give you those insights, you know, to support the conviction of buying the asset. And so if the revenue synergies represent that exciting ceiling, Dean, but they're, you know, maybe carry the most uncertainty, what about the other side of the coin, the cost synergies that maybe helps an acquirer build like a floor for value creation?
And you got to be careful here. I would say that those that are successful, you know, they try to avoid flat percentage savings. Instead, they kind of focus on more of a granular approach, mapping out the costs and operating models to identify those opportunities, like migrating, let's say, to a single shared service model, let's say for finance or HR. That's the way you go about it. I think people come out with big headlines and they argue, I'll say this. It can be the case. But going back to the how, you got to make sure you have a plan in place. And I believe the granular approach is the way to go.
And so, Carol, like on that point, how do you advise companies on how to prioritize and sequence these synergies? Like, is there wisdom in starting with some quick wins, you know, before you get into those high risk, high reward opportunities?
For sure. I mean, what we advise our clients to do is speed to value, right? So you need to look at both the complexity of achieving those synergies, but also the magnitude of the synergies. So we have these value trackers that we identify what are the different synergies that the client needs to go after, how significant are they, focus on the biggest dollar amounts, and then the ones that speed to value of how you can capture them the fastest.
Yeah, and I'd say on top of that, Nick, the biggest challenge is, do you have a strategy around it? And you dedicated an IMO to oversee the execution and maintain accountability. Do you have leadership buy-in? Because if senior leaders aren't driving this, this won't be permeating throughout the organization. Is there an overall robust plan day one, the first 100 days, the first year? And are you focusing on the retention of key talent? And how are you navigating communication to reduce the uncertainty? Uncertainty is a big deal. The way we talked about it in the deal market, if you've got a bunch of employees uncertain of their future, that could cause some issue with the overall integration of the deal as well.
I think those are great strategies for, you know, how you actually achieve value creation as opposed to destroying value, as we see more often than not. Carol, when you think about that M&A study that we've talked about a couple of times, I know there were some other features of winning acquirers that we found through our data. Can you just share a couple of what those things were?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to. You know, I think a few things that are noteworthy. First, it was interesting to find that habitual acquirers were consistently outperforming their peers, which really indicates to us is that, you know, and we kind of think this way, of course, that M&A is really a skill that can be honed. And so the more you do it, the better you get at doing it. So that was one finding we had. The second one was really around scale matters and having scale-focused mergers where you're acquiring a direct competitor really demonstrates the highest rate of success. And then really the last one is that domestic deals outperform cross-border deals.
The first one you pointed out about, you know, being a habitual acquirer, I was just reading an article yesterday that it had data showing that not only do habitual acquirers outperform their peers in what I'll call like normal conditions, I'm using air quotes, but that outperformance is even more pronounced in periods of high uncertainty. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, you know, given the state of play that we're in right now. Dean, let me try to flip that question around for the sell side. I guess, you know, if we think about these sellers that are potentially coming online in this cautious yet optimistic market, what are some winning strategies in terms of how they can maximize value?
As a seller, you got to sit back and make sure that you're always managing your portfolio, what is core to your business, to make sure that you're able to grow post the transaction.
Yeah, like it seems like a seller would be well equipped to do that mock simulation of what the buyer is going to potentially uncover in diligence and get in front of it. Am I right?
Absolutely, Nick. And much of what we spent time doing is getting companies ready for sale. And that was part of the conversation is looking at, hate to say, do you have an ugly baby here? You got to make sure you acknowledge that and spend time looking at where the hair may be and what the buyer may attack. It gives you a chance to go ahead and improve performance prior to the transaction. So interesting enough, what we saw in our business is in a stalled deal market, those sellers were spending time to make sure the asset was ready for sale. And using our services to make sure when the buyer came to buy them, they weren't going to go ahead and poke holes and say, we'll lower the overall purchase price because of the flaws in the system. So I do believe it's really critical to make sure you're doing that internal assessment of sell side diligence to get ready for the sale.
And Dean, you kind of mentioned it there, but I would also add on that in this slower deal market, our clients have also been trying to optimize their business. So one of the things that I said, you know, kind of the three types of synergies, the last one was just operational effectiveness and optimizing the business. A lot of our sellers have been focused on how do they really drive the most value by optimizing their business today. And so that the cost savings that they might be able to go after, they've already started to realize.
Yeah, it seems more critical now than ever. And I guess, you know, this has been extremely insightful for me. I mean, we've covered the market, how you create value, what buyers and sellers should be thinking about now. I guess as we wrap up, I'll just ask you guys an open-ended question. Any parting thoughts, wisdom you want to leave for our listeners who may be thinking about dipping their toe in the water, back to the Jaws analogy, or in the middle of a deal right now?
Maybe I'll start. I would just say, do not be afraid of what's to come. And so you have more tools at your disposal. Use them. Bring in experts in areas you're not an expert and ensure you get the top dollar value for your organization. I do believe right now is the time for people to strike, and you're going to create some FOMO in the market today, Nick, because as more deals get announced, It's going to help people on the sidelines. It's time to get into the game because you get in too late, things get really, really expensive, and those good assets could be gone.
Totally agree with Dean's comments. So maybe I'll take an opposite view of, you know, sometimes the best deals you do are the deals that you don't do. So I would say, I think we're going to be moving into 26 as being a very frothy deal market. Just because it's a frothy deal market doesn't mean it's always going to be a good deal market for your individual needs.
And those two perspectives to me, like, perfectly sum up this exact moment we're in, you know, and which way it goes is going to be fascinating. So can't thank you guys enough. You know, Dean, Carol, really appreciate you being on. Thanks for your time and your expertise.
Thanks so much, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
A huge thanks to both Dean Bell and Carol Stryker for coming on and giving us that masterclass in navigating the M&A market. Whether you just finished the full episode and you want a quick recap, or you're just now tuning in for the highlights on the bottom line, let me summarize what my key takeaways were from the conversation. Number one, the M&A market feels like it's at a real inflection point. After years of compound volatility and uncertainty, dealmakers are no longer waiting for this storm to pass. They've learned to navigate it, and that's coming through in the data. The market is heating up. Buyers are ready to spend, and sellers are starting to test the waters. But don't expect the return to the deal fever of 2021 just yet. Buyers are much more disciplined now, and they're using every tool in their toolkit, from AI in diligence to sophisticated scenario modeling, to get comfortable with today's risks. And the result? The bar for what constitutes a good deal, it's simply much higher than it was a few years ago. My second takeaway for buyers, value creation is much easier said than done. This one really struck me, the fact that our research shows that over half of all deals actually destroy rather than create value for shareholders. I mean, that's just mind-boggling. And what we've learned is that the companies who do deals regularly consistently outperform their peers, especially in periods of high uncertainty. They're the ones who beat that 57% failure rate. And they do it by following a playbook. They have strong conviction in a crystal clear deal thesis, which drives everything they do from diligence to integration. It all ties back. And it's proof that M&A is a skill that can be honed. As Dean put it, it's about treating M&A as a continuous core business capability, not a one-off event. And finally, for sellers, proactive preparation is paramount. Try saying that five times fast. In today's market of all these disciplined buyers, the most successful sellers are the ones who are treating the pre-sale period as a value creation opportunity in itself. It's not just about doing mock diligence to find your flaws anymore. It's about proactively optimizing the business, realizing operational efficiencies, and managing your portfolio so that you're selling from a position of strength. The goal is to present an asset that's not just ready for sale, but is already performing at its best. And that proactive work is what protects your valuation and ultimately controls the narrative. I'm Nick Tricarci, and this has been The Bottom Line. If you want more data-driven insights on M&A, I highly, highly recommend checking out our M&A dance study that we referred to throughout the episode. It really is fantastic. I put the link in the show notes. And please be sure to subscribe, leave us a review, and reach out if there's topics you want to tackle in the future, or if you're in the middle of a deal and you're looking for some advice. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you later.